White Sox and Orioles in Baltimore. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny and hot today, a high of 86. Temperatures are climbing slowly. Now 70 Racine, 69 Kenosha, 64 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're really pleased to be able to have a conversation today about the intersection of science and art. And we have with us in the studios, first of all, someone who will be a very familiar name and voice to any of you who are frequent Morning Show listeners, Dr. Thomas Carr, Associate Professor of Biology at Carthage and Director of Carthage College's Institute of Paleontology. And we have had Dr. Carr on the program any number of times, primarily to talk about the dinosaur digs he engages in out west in rural Montana. And again, he is back from another such expedition, but we're actually going to be having a slightly different focus today. With Dr. Carr today in our studios is Matthew Warren Lee, who is a professor at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, a talented oil painter who has been a part of many of these expeditions out west to Montana with Dr. Carr. And we're going to be talking about that interesting connection and what it means to have artists on hand, because actually Matthew Warren Lee is often a part of these expeditions, and some of his students at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design are also part of this program and part of this experience. And we'll be talking about what they bring to it with the artist's eye and the artist's perspective and the kind of work that they do to create, in a sense, a record of what is found and what is experienced in these dinosaur digs out at the Hell Creek Formation in rural Montana. Dr. Thomas Carr and Matthew Warren Lee, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Glad you, Dorothy. I'm so glad that we can do this. Dr. Carr, thanks for suggesting this conversation. I think it's a wonderful idea. I'm excited about it. Take us back to the beginning of your connection with Matthew Warren Lee. Explain to our listeners the circumstances under which you met back in 2015.
As memory serves, I received an email out of the clear blue sky from Matthew, I think, asking about just the opportunity to join us out in Montana, if memory serves. I think that's correct. Matthew's supervisor at the time, I think, suggested reaching out to me. Matthew has extensive experience working in Antarctica, and so that sparked something to suggest that Matthew reach out and inquire about joining us in the field, and I was really happy that that opportunity came my way.
So Matthew was teaching at Carthage at the time, which is why this connection sort of logistically made sense.
Yes.
Very good. So it's been that was the first connection among many which have occurred over the years, and as I said in the introduction, Matthew has served as both a volunteer participant, but also as an instructor in the paleontology program. How many times have you been on these expeditions with Dr. Carr over the years?
I just completed my sixth, and this was the first time I was there for the entire month. So I did 4 weeks in the field.
So you just keep coming back for more punishment.
I do.
Very good. Well, let's first of all get a little bit of background from you, since you are a newcomer to the program. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about where you come from originally, and maybe at what point in your, I assume, early life these two threads began to emerge and intertwine. That is, your interest in the arts, but also your interest in science.
Yeah, I was always interested in art. I couldn't even say where that really began. So I pursued that as a young artist, and I was actually a portrait painter. And then when I got out of my undergrad, I was sort of a little bit lost, I think, like a lot of people are, not knowing what I should do. And I ended up talking to a friend and ended up in the United States Antarctic Program. And I did that for several years, went to Antarctica, a portrait painter, and came back a landscape painter interested in science. It was just hard to, I think, or not hard, but impossible to see what I've seen down there with, like, science and the technology and the people working on those projects, and not pivot and start thinking about that stuff and what kind of contribution I might make to science. And how I can help. And then it was almost fate or something that I became involved with CIP and got to go on digs, because I can't go to Antarctica anymore. You have to kind of give up your whole life. You can't. You know, I was there for 6 months and 13 months.
Wow.
So being able to spend my summers in Montana and then teach during the year and work on my studio practice has just been really amazing.
Great. So growing up then, you were not a particularly science-oriented youngster? I mean, the things that you were studying or learning in science did not spark too much in you? I mean, at least not compared to what's happened since?
Yeah, I would say that I wasn't as a young person. I think I was science-minded and mathematics-minded, but I wasn't particularly devoted to science or math. Like, I found out that I was in love with that stuff when I was a little older.
So what you were in love with as a young person was art.
Yeah, painting and animation and design.
Right. So when you did your undergrad, wherever that was, did you have any aspirations whatsoever that you wanted to become a professional artist? I mean, you mentioned sort of feeling lost when you finished out undergrad. Is it simply a matter of not knowing what you wanted to do or how you should do it? Or
I knew I wanted to make art. I didn't know exactly how I was going to make that work. And science kind of presented itself, and then that's when I fell in love with it. It's hard to, I think, go to Antarctica or go out to Montana and dig up dinosaurs and not be completely immersed in it and become effectively obsessed.
Right. It does cast a spell, I suppose.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the circumstances under which, I was going to say, you learned about Antarctica. I don't mean that, but this opportunity that apparently crossed your path to actually go to Antarctica and do work there. Under what circumstances did that occur?
For Antarctica, I was just working like a regular job at a restaurant and making art on my own in Madison at the time. And I met a friend of mine who had done it, who had gone to Antarctica, to McMurdo Station on the coast for the summer. And I just in passing mentioned to him, hey, that's really interesting. You should get me in on that or something, you know, not thinking anything of it. And then one email led to another, and next thing I was at the hospital getting tested for every imaginable ailment and thing and to get physically qualified to go. And then I heard nothing back from USAP for a long time. That's the United States Antarctic Program. And I was like, I wonder what ever happened with that, because I did a lot of work, you know, like paperwork and stuff for them, and I just didn't hear anything from them. So I called them one day, and they said, oh, yeah, you're deploying in 2 weeks. You're flying to the coast of Antarctica. We've got your ticket to New Zealand. You need to do this, this, and this. So quit my job that day and disappeared. So, and then once I got to the coast of Antarctica, which is beautiful, it's up in the Trans-Antarctic Mountains, then I got the itch, because you're about 800 miles from the South Pole, and everybody wants to set foot at the South Pole.
Sure.
So I filed the paperwork and talked to people and did all that stuff, and then I got a job there for the summer. And then after I got to the South Pole, I was like, well, that's amazing, but I want to spend the winter, which is very rare. Very few people have ever done it. So I started beating the drum and trying to figure out how to do that, and then I got that eventually as well. But I was just doing science support when I was there. I was a porter, which is kind of like almost odd jobs. Like, my job was to scrub the galley and make sure that people had, you know, linens ready in their room for when they got off the plane, and then maintenance over the winter to make sure that the place is, you know, upkept along with the skeleton crew of people that are there. There was 48 of us.
Wow. I'm just curious, Dr. Carr, your ears perked up when you heard that Matthew Warren Lee had been to Antarctica. Was there any particular reason why that was such a point of fascination for you? I mean, is that someplace you've been or aspire to go? Or is that sort of holy ground for paleontologists? I mean, or was it just because it's something you don't hear every day?
Well, I guess it's a bit of a combination of all of that, but primarily it's one of the most remote places on the planet. Not many people go there. And since Matthew was there in a capacity of science support, that's a fairly unique position to take, you know, very integral one to the process of science. And so, you know, it's clear to me that Matthew sort of understood the process of the grunt work side of science, and sort of has a familiarity with logistics and that sort of thing. Not that, you know, I'd view his participation with us in the same capacity, but it's just a unique qualification, and it's not something everyone has. And of course, you know, Antarctica is a place that pushes and changes people, and Montana is similar in that fashion, and inspiring scientifically and artistically.
For those of you just joining us, you're hearing right now the familiar voice of Dr. Thomas Carr, a frequent guest to the morning show. He is director of the Carthage College Institute of Paleontology. And with him, paying his first visit to the program, is Matthew Warren Lee, who is on the faculty of the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, and is also someone who has been a repeat participant and even an instructor in the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. We're going to spend a few more minutes talking about Antarctica, which, Dr. Carr, in the article you shared with me that you wrote about Matthew, you called Antarctica the harshest environment on the planet, and I don't think anyone who's been there will probably argue with you. So Matthew Warren Lee, explain the presence on the continent of Antarctica of this program. Did you call it USAP?
Yeah, United States Antarctic Program.
Yeah, give us at least kind of a general idea of what they are doing there, the nature of the kind of study that they undertake there.
Oh, well, around the coast of Antarctica, there's a lot of stuff going on with biology. And I was there for 6 months. There's various field camps around there. Dinosaur camp opened the year after I left, ironically, where they started pulling dinosaurs out of Antarctica. And also a lot of work on climate. The geographic South Pole is very different. It's at an extremely high altitude, and as mentioned, it's a very harsh environment. It's at extremely high altitude. It's very, very dry. There's no moisture, and it's free from light pollution for about 6 months out of the year. It's just dark. The sun never rises. That makes it basically an ideal environment to place telescopes of all kind, optical telescopes. We also have the South Pole Telescope there, which is a radiation telescope. It's really amazing. It found the largest object ever found by human beings, which was a galaxy cluster the size of 800 trillion suns at the edge of the universe that was created just after the Big Bang. And then also Ice Cube, which is a neutrino detector, which I believe, I went to the lectures, I'd understand parts of them. They're wonderful things to go to. But again, I'm an artist, so I absorb what I can. But it's my understanding that it can produce the first robust data on the existence of extra dimensions. So it's like science with a capital S. It's the big stuff. And I believe NASA calls it cheap science because it's cheaper than sending the stuff into space. Though it's still, I'm sure, incredibly expensive. So that's the kind of stuff that I was surrounded by. And like I said, it's after you learn those things, you're like, it's hard to, it would be impossible to ignore them. Like, I had to address it in my own mind, and then, of course, in my work.
Right. So, just to reiterate, you were not there as a scientist at all.
No, no.
Right. So, I'm curious about your relationship with and interaction with those who were there as scientists. I mean, did you have significant interaction with them? I mean, kind of what was your relationship? How did you fit into that small community?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, during the day, I was kind of in solitude working on my own. But every time you went into the galley to have breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or get a snack, you could just sit down with random people and talk to them, start up conversations. And I met people from all over the world studying amazing things, and I learned a ton just sitting around a dinner table with those people. And McMurdo is very large, 1,500 people in the summer. But Pole is very intimate, like 150 people or more in the summer, and then there was 47 of us, well, 48 including me, for the 9-ish months of winter. So I made friends with people, scientists, telescope mechanics, like all sorts of fascinating people that I've become lifelong friends with.
Hmm. So tell us about your artistic endeavors while you were in Antarctica. And going there at the outset, did you have certain ideas or expectations about how much art and what kind of art you would create there versus what ultimately occurred?
Yeah, I think I was surprised at where the direction that the work went. I was very people centered when I first went to Antarctica, like portraiture and stuff like that. But by the time those 3 years in the program had elapsed, I was a lot more interested in architecture, and these, because the machines there are huge, that kind of stuff. It really shifted. So when I left Antarctica, I ended up in grad school at UW-Milwaukee, and that's when I started to really process what I wanted my contribution to be. So for those who haven't seen my paintings, my main focus is in these large landscapes that have different types of scientific devices in them, machines.
And we see very few, if any, people in those landscapes, generally speaking, that's the case. But, I mean, there's kind of a striking absence of, I think the way you phrased it, Thomas, in your article, we don't see the builders or the creators or the users of this equipment or technology, generally speaking. Is there a particular reason for that, what I assume is a conscious choice?
Yes, it is. Antarctica's amazing, but it's also cold, literally and figuratively, and almost like indifferent in a way to our presence. Hmm. So it's a place where we go to know the world and to investigate the world. But it can also be quite lonely, and I think that's initially why I started to do that. And then I began to think more about the technology as a human proxy, like it stands in for like a greater humanity.
Interesting. So during those winter months at the South Pole, where it came down to a much smaller group of 48 altogether, were you in a sense the only non-scientist there?
Oh, no. That's what I like to stress to my students too, because they get very confused when I start telling them these things that I'm working on and what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you went to school for science? No, I'm a painter. You know, I studied art and design. But in Antarctica, I believe it's like for every one scientist, there would be 10 support people.
Wow.
So people like me, people that are cooking, people that are cleaning, carpenters, heavy machine operators, people that are fueling planes, flying planes. It takes a lot of human beings to make a project like that work. And that's true, too, of CIP and going out to Montana.
So I guess that's what you were getting at in terms of Matthew's particular resume and the valuable role or roles that he could play in what you do.
Yeah, precisely. After having experience like that in Antarctica, Matthew would have the mindset and understanding of what it takes to be a support, you know, not only, you know, as a participant in many different ways, from, you know, collecting fossils to just, you know, cleaning dishes. And what's interesting is sort of for us, the ratio pretty much works out that way. So it's Dr. Seitz and I run the thing. We're the ones you know, at the end of the day, we'll be studying the fossils and colleagues beyond that. But we have a support of, you know, 13, 14 people in any given time. So that's interesting that, you know, that ratio of support to scientists is similar. But more important than that is that, you know, Matthew has the working knowledge of just how this sort of thing works. Not everyone does. Everyone finds their place, which is fine, and that's something that does inevitably happen, but Matthew comes in with that extra experience and maturity.
By the way, he mentioned that that work on dinosaur expeditions began right after he left Antarctica, which was a unfortunate bit of timing, but I'm just curious, what kind of a opportunity does Antarctica give to paleontologists?
It's very rich, relatively speaking, especially for the Mesozoic, so that's the age of dinosaurs. There's several, I think, regular expeditions from various institutions like Augustana College, Field Museum, University of Alberta, that sort of thing, and where dinosaur fossils are collected, other vertebrates, marine reptiles. So it's quite productive, Antarctica is, and so it's a very valuable place on the map for understanding, you know, the early history of our planet. And, you know, simultaneously there's these various telescopes that enable us to learn about the deep past, so of the universe. And so there's a nice complementarity at work there. I'm not involved with Antarctic research. My hands are full in Montana. But Antarctica is as important as any place on the planet.
Wow.
For understanding the evolution of life on this planet and, you know, climatic changes through deep time.
So, Matthew Warren Lee, what's it like to be particularly at the South Pole, so at the very center of Antarctica, and particularly during those long months of winter? I mean, what kind of an experience was that? I mean, sort of mentally and emotionally, and also artistically for you, what was that experience like?
It certainly wasn't easy. The last plane leaves, and you're there for about, I think, like about 9 months, maybe, before the first plane comes in for summer. So that you're left there with a skeleton crew. For me, it was around 50 people, and you're stuck there. You couldn't leave if you wanted to. So you end up in this very close-knit and tight community. And then, artistically, I was doing a lot of what I do in Montana, which is writing and then drawing in tandem with that to document my experience. And then in addition to that, I did a lot of watercolors. I did some self-portraits in that time still, which were pretty introspective about what was happening to me and my experience. But yeah, it was difficult, but I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. It's one of the defining events of my life.
So if I understood from the two of you chatting before we went on the air, shortly after meeting Dr. Carr, you decided to come along on one of his next expeditions out to rural Montana. And it was one of the last times you camped in Montana.
Yeah.
So first of all, explain that distinction. What were the expeditions like when you were camping there? Versus the lap of luxury you enjoy now?
Oh, they were terrible experiences. I'd never do it again. camping required hauling out, you know, safari tents, hauling out water. And then the only vehicles we had at the time were vans, so we could only take those so far, then haul everything out, set up camp, and then start the field season. And we would have to hike out to our various localities, which was just physically punishing. And so we would basically lose half our time to, you know, to all that junk. And the landowners saw us doing this and thought we were clearly out of our minds, and just and suggested, why don't you just rent ATVs and rent this house we have as a base of operations. We did that, I think, in 20, I can't recall which year it was, but we did that, and we've never looked back. And the benefit is that we do use ATVs. We rent the house where we sleep and eat and prepare meals. And we've never looked back, because what we gained was a crew that has energy, and we gained so much time back.
Right.
And made it really worthwhile. So as one of our stalwart volunteers, Andrew Parisi, would say, each year we get a little bit better.
Mm.
And so we're still on that curve of improvement, I'm happy to say.
Right. And I remember you mentioning you're kind of shocked. Now that you look back, you're shocked that anybody would come back for a second go-round in that before, when it was so incredibly arduous.
Yeah, and we actually developed a reputation among vert paleos as being one of the toughest or roughest field programs out there. Which I'm hopefully a reputation that we've now shed.
The morning I arrived for my first dig was the morning after a storm had just destroyed the entire camp. It was like a ruin that we had to put back together that day.
Wow, and it made you long for the simple days of Antarctica. Huh?
Yeah.
So, Matthew, explain what your role was right off the bat in that very first expedition out to Montana. I mean, your first expedition out to Montana, and what your role was at the outset in terms of being an artist.
Oh, yeah. So I did a lot of sketchbooking that year, again, drawing and writing and looking a lot at landscape. And drawing a lot of the landscape and the downtime that we did have at camp. And it was hard, but I loved the camping part of it. It was really beautiful and very remote and profound. So that first season, I was really just like learning the lay of the land. When you first get there, it's like, it's hard to know what's a rock and what's a bone, you know? So it was really the basics of figuring out the process of finding things and excavating things. I did a lot of shoveling that first season because we have to remove overburden to get down to the bone bed of the quarry to find the rest of our specimens. And then just logistics, carrying things, water, stuff like that, keeping things kept up at camp, cooking.
So Dr. Carr, what were your aspirations for Matthew as a participant in this program? And I suspect that his presence and his role evolved over time from what he's just described from that first time.
Yeah. So the way I view the crew is it ought to be a diverse crew, you know, across all fronts, including professional. And I think that there aren't many opportunities for artists, in particular fine artists, whether they're visual, literary, musical, to participate in the process of science directly. Just on a superficial level, there's some art out there that sort of comments on science, but it's clear to me that the artist hasn't really participated firsthand. And so I want to keep an open door to artists of all stripes with us, to join us. And that does include graphic novel artists, poets, nonfiction writers, musicians, and also oil painters, such as and including Matthew. And it's really rewarding for me to see the art actually happening in the field, say back at the house when during downtime, even seeing artists working together. We had graphic novel artist Adam Gorham out with us at the same time as Matthew one year, and there was one afternoon where they were both sketching at the house at the table across from each other. And I really want to see art happen. I want to become an inspiring place that we're artists encounter new forms and ideas to explore. So I want us to function as a catalyst. It's not just one way. That yes, we are benefiting from their efforts and their labor and their time, but I also want to see art flourish in an informed way. Mm. And it does happen, I'm happy to say.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the Institute of Paleontology at Carthage College, associate professor of biology there, and also senior advisor for the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha. And with us as well in the studio, Matthew Warren Lee, who is a professor at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, an oil painter, primarily a landscape painter from Milwaukee, and someone who has been a part of quite a number of the dinosaur digs out in rural Montana at the Hell Creek Formation. So it sounds like Matthew was a very quick study in terms of learning what it takes to do this kind of work. And I suppose that's a big relief. I mean that very quickly he became someone who could function and really be quite successful, quite proficient.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's difficult to predict, you know, how people will function in that environment. It's a very, it can be stressful. It can be high pressure. But the idea is for people to enjoy themselves and also contribute to science at the same time. And so, you know, as I mentioned earlier with Matthew's experience in Antarctica, a quick study indeed he turned out to be. And, you know, Montana is a place that will push people, like, you know, in terms of push them physically and mentally. And it's hard to predict who will be back from year to year. You know, I just assume that everyone will leaves each field season resentful. Well, you will never see them again. But right. I consider that we're extraordinarily lucky to have Matthew back as a return volunteer from year to year, and also, you know, bring out his own students in parallel with ours.
Right. So tell us about that, Matthew, the idea of bringing students, art students, from the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. What do you see as the kind of the central purpose or point of that?
Well, I've gotten so much out of it on a number of levels, definitely artistically, but also me as a person. It's just a complete like revitalization of the mind being out there. It's almost impossible to describe. So I wanted to bring that to my own students, and I knew they were interested because whenever it came up, they were like, "What? You're an artist. How'd you go do these things?" And I was like, "Well, you can go do these things too, right?" So that's how I ended up proposing the idea to Dr. Carr of bringing students from MIAD. And we did that for 3 years, brought groups of 7 students and then myself and another faculty member out there. And the response from them has been amazing. I mean, we have students, former students and current students, who are now volunteers that return. So I'm like out on the dig, and then, you know, the groups will switch out to the volunteer session, and it'll be my former students sitting around the table that have come back to dig up dinosaurs. So it's really great. And it's also, it's gotten a presence at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design as well, in that there is an enthusiasm around that as a project, and that it's very rare that an art institute would be able to offer something like that to their students. And I think it's been really, I think, really good in terms of, I would say, like science communication, to get artists to start moving that information around the community.
Very good. So I'm curious about this blending of art with science, and the fact that, for instance, in science there is a rigor for the factual record, the actual historical record. I mean, that's the your motto, una historia, una veritas, one history, one truth. Mm-hmm. So what would be the difference between creating a record of what was found with cameras? I mean, with the clarity of a photograph, that in which there is no, I mean, at least in the common sense of the word, there's no room for kind of interpretation, versus an artist's eye, which involves a fair amount of subjectivity and so on. So it seems like those two notions are a little bit at odds with one another. but you obviously see them as actually complementary.
Yeah, I mean, the whole purpose of the civilizational project is for the human mind to flourish, and it can only flourish with a deep and informed understanding of nature and humanity's place in it. And we need bridges between, the scientific side, where all that hard quantitative work is done, and we need people to bridge from there back to civilization, to people who aren't scientists but may have an interest in our origins, the origin of the planet, the origin of life, and so on. And so I see it as a complementary project, not one in conflict or tension. The main conflict there is when artists have no experience of science or no knowledge of it, but then dive in nonetheless, without any, throwing all caution to the wind. So that's, specifically my goal, is to have artists who are informed about the way science really works so that they can be effective bridges and even critics, just as long as there is, it's based on actual experience of how science really works.
Right. What would you add to that, Matthew?
If you ask me what is art and what is science, I would give you the same answer, which is that it's to know the world. And that's what I like about both, is how investigative they are. And I would also say that since the dawn of vertebrate paleontology, artists have always been involved from day one, because it requires so much reconstruction, trying to figure out from the bits and pieces what things actually looked like. And at least within the first, 40 years when Waterhouse came along, the public imagination around Dinosauria just blew up. And artists were the ones that made that happen, to get this stuff into the popular imagination and then have the field accelerate and move forward.
I'd never even stopped to think about that. I mean, I'm just thinking about, so point your camera at whatever, except whatever isn't there. All we have are small fragments of what this creature was in its totality. Yeah. And so it is artists who help, in a sense, fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I see what we're up to as sort of a step beyond that, and that is, to provide a commentary on the process of science, its value, its civilizational value. I think our current time could be described as a nadir of the understanding of science and its importance. We're sort of caught in this, for the worst, I think, this postmodern gyre of subjectivity, and thinking that just its opinions valid and opinions okay all the way down. Well, that's not true. There is such thing as reality. We have the means to understand it, and we have the means, the artistic means, to share the beauty and fascination, the insights that science brings, to humanity. So I see our purpose as, or at least the CIP artistic project, if there is one, that's the basic purpose, is the, a clear expression of what science is really up to and its value to everybody.
Right. Is this a connection and interplay that has mattered to you for a long time, or is this relatively recent for you, that is, this understanding of the importance of both worlds and of building bridges between them? I mean, have you just fairly recently come to understand the importance of that?
I've always been interested in the arts. I've, always drawn stuff. I was actually a finalist for the Poet Laureate of Racine a few years ago. Okay. So, and also my own biological parents were artists. Robert Langley Bloor was a Canadian abstract painter. My biological mother, Dorothy Cameron, was sort of a multimedia artist, I think less well-known as Ron. I think she only had one show, but she did run an art gallery in Toronto and in Yorkville back in the 60s. It was raided by the police for showing obscene works, which was something that she fought all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada and unfortunately lost. Huh. So yeah, I've never really seen much of a of a divide or a conflict between art and science. I see them as common civilizational projects, but the science does form the bedrock of what we actually know and sort of orients, you know, our critiques of our current actions, you know.
Very good. I don't want to take too much time because we still have to talk about what Matthew Warren Lee discovered out in Montana. Can we just touch briefly on art other than the visual arts? I mean, mm-hmm. those who might write poems or in other ways bring artistic talents to bear on this. What kind of a presence has that been thus far?
Well, when we have people out, I don't really impose anything on anybody. I'll frame, you know, an invitation to a participant just as an opportunity to participate in science, and I might mention, you know, it's something that might be inspiring. We had, I mentioned before, graphic novelist Adam Gorham out with us, and he kept a sketchbook, and I think he had some ideas for pursuing some paleo-related projects. Last summer, we had Christopher Dewdney, who's a well-known Canadian poet and nonfiction writer. And, you know, just to have their presence and to see an inspiring place and to observe their interactions and how they describe that to others is rewarding enough. Hmm. You know, so there's no expectation that art will happen. It's just something I'd like to see happen spontaneously, and I think that it makes for a more enriching intellectual environment among the crew that are there.
I'm sure you're right about that.
It should be stimulating for everybody, yeah. for the artists included.
Terrific. Matthew Warren Lee, I know that one of the things that you would have with students coming from MIAD, where you teach, is that they have to keep an illustrated diary or journal of their experiences there. I suppose that's an interesting experience for them to not only experience things, but then have to, in a sense, record it, preserve it in that particular way.
Yeah. Documentation is really vitally important. I don't think I realized that before I started being involved with the digs, but writing and drawing and just general documentation is so important. It's the same thing that the paleontologists are doing. I thought, well, artists would be great at that, you know. And that was my project, and then my project just extended it being the project for my students, that they keep these dinosaur diaries. And then when they get back to MIAD after their 2 weeks in the field, we spend another week about creating some kind of final project or proposal for a project, and that might be redesigning murals for a museum. It may be creating paintings, fine art. It could be creating a children's book. Depending on what the students are interested in, they come up with all sorts of different things, and that's a wonderful experience for me too, to see how did this affect their brain and their approach, and what are they going to do with this information that they've now acquired.
Before we let you go, I know that last summer you had an exciting experience of discovering something out in rural Montana. My understanding is you'd been digging one place, you kind of ventured out into some different location, and tell our listeners what you found.
Oh, I hope this I'm referencing the right story. It was the day before I was supposed to leave, and I found a ton of stuff. Surface collect fossils, and I was bagging them frantically because I was running out of time. And one of my bags flew away, like the plastic bags, which would be, you know, littering. Like that's heresy out in the bone beds of Hell Creek. So I dropped what I was doing and I dropped my pack and I ran after this piece of plastic. And I did it. I got it. You know, so I got my hand on it and I looked up and an orbital Triceratops orbital, which is the great big gigantic horn above the eyes, was sticking out of the mountain and weathering out there. So I frantically collected the coordinates for that so that we could go back and pick it up the following year or after I had left, for those who had stayed behind.
Tell us more about that, Dr. Carr, and how significant that was.
Well, everything is, you know, is in terms of information, fossils are valuable because of the information that they contain. And so every new Triceratops is important for helping us understand Triceratops. So let's pretend that you know, all we knew of humanity was, say, our three skeletons here in this studio.
Mm.
And that does not map onto the variation that we see among 7 billion people.
Right.
So for science, sample size is everything. And that's why it's a tragedy when dinosaur fossils like the Gorgosaurus recently auctioned in New York, or Stan the T-Rex, which was auctioned for $32 million last year, really hurt science in a substantial and sharp way. And so I think in the space of a few hours, Meth, or maybe it was over a couple days, Matthew found 3 new Triceratops localities, which is extraordinary. And so that helps boost our sample size for that animal. It also adds several years to our field program, so there's no end in sight, which is a great thing. You know, we have decades, if not centuries, of work ahead of us out there. And so that adds to our herd of Triceratops that we have to collect, you know, as long as we're able.
You mentioned in the article that you wrote that about Matthew that when somebody discovers a new locality, that's how I think you described it, they get to name it.
Yes.
That's the tradition. So explain how you went about naming these 3 localities of new Triceratops.
Yeah, I'm actually up to 5 now, I think, for localities. Possibly 6. I think I found one this year.
Yep.
Okay, good. Good to know. Sometimes you don't know until like long after you get the stuff back to the museum and you got to look through it. Like I said, I wasn't like severely interested in, as a very young person, in math and science, but in my early 20s, I did completely fall in love with geometry and other areas of mathematics. So I decided that in Montana, every time I found a new site that I got naming rights to, that I would name it after a famous or noteworthy mathematician or physicist. So that's what I've stuck to for all of the places that I've found.
So tell our listeners about these 3 localities then.
The first one is called Conway's Thrackle. John Horton Conway was a British mathematician who worked in graph theory. So he was very intent on using drawing and games to figure out mathematics. I named one after Srinivasa Ramanujan, who's an Indian mathematician, who made incredible, almost magical contributions to mathematics in his very short life. And then I think I did the third one for Myra Mirzakhani, who is Iranian but operative in the United States, and she was the first female mathematician to win a Fields Medal, which is the highest honor that you can get in mathematics. And she's great. I love watching her lectures, but I understand next to nothing. But it's just watching her work and draw is just like, it's absolutely profound.
Wow. Well, that's just one more way in which some of these worlds that we tend to think of as completely distinct are, in fact, blending all the time. And how wonderful that this project helps to nurture that interaction.
Yeah, and hopefully for many years to come.
Yeah. So, Matthew, are you intending to head out to Montana again and again and again?
Yes, indefinitely. I've only been back for a week, and I still know I just did it because of how my knees and back feel. But yesterday I was daydreaming about being there. It's just, it's hard work, and that's fine, but it's just an amazing corner of the world, filled with amazing things and amazing people, and yeah, I would never give it up.
Well, we're so glad that you could join us on the morning show today to talk about this experience that you've had and all the contributions that you are making to Carthage's paleontology program. Matthew Warren Lee, a professor at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. It was great to meet you and have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, Dr. Thomas Carr, no stranger to the morning show, Associate Professor of Biology, Carthage College's Institute for Paleontology Director, and a Senior Advisor to the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha. Thank you for being back on the morning show as well. Look forward to a return visit, maybe with Megan Seitz and some of your students.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, a conversation with Emma Lynn, who is the author of a really fascinating book called Gray Matters, in which she explores some of the means by which people later in life can actually experience some of their most deeply meaningful years of existence and the ways in which we are aging differently than was once the case. So that will be tomorrow on The Morning Show, the author of this really intriguing book called Gray Matters.